Presenting radio's foremost laboratory of new writing and production techniques, the Columbia Workshop. How radars save democracy. Today's script was written by Cecil McGivern and was originally presented by the British Broadcasting Corporation under the supervision of Lawrence Gilliam. It has been shortened for presentation by the Columbia Workshop, and new music has been composed for the American production by Alexander Semler. John Dietz is today's director. How radars save democracy.
This is the story behind the story of the Battle of Britain. It is the story of an invention conceived in secrecy, born and developed in secrecy, and used against the enemy with terrible force. It is the story of an achievement of British science and of a band of British scientists who left their universities and schools and laboratories to work alongside the Royal Air Force.
Yes, if it's anything, it's the story of a partnership.
A great partnership, Boffin.
Boffin?
That's what you RAF men call us radar scientists. Boffins.
Oh, what did you call the RAF, Boffin?
Oh.
Well, some very nasty names at times, eh, Boffin?
Yes, we had rows. What partnership hasn't?
We fought like cats at times, but it worked. We sat in their labs, and they flew in our aircraft.
If the enemy had done the same, it would have been a longer war. But in radiolocation, he didn't, strangely enough. We were well ahead of him most of the time. Yes, if you want to tell a story, that's the one to tell.
It will emerge, I think. But this story needs a prologue. What is radar? Answer to be given in words of one syllable. Ready, Boffin? Off you go.
Standing beside me is a man. A short distance away is a hill. Would you be good enough, sir, to face the hill and shout?
Certainly.
Oi! Oi!
The shout hits the hill and it comes back to us as an echo. Again, sir.
Oi! Oi!
Now, we know the speed at which sound travels. If we take a stopwatch and time the interval between the shout and the echo, we can very easily work out the distance the man is from the hill. Now, instead of a man, we have a transmitter, which sends out an oi made up of radio waves. And instead of a hill, we have an aeroplane out of sight and sound. Conductor, would your orchestra be the transmitter and give us something to represent a radio wave?
Certainly.
Out it goes into space, hits the aeroplane, and is reflected back to us. Out it goes again, hits the aircraft, and back to us. Again, faster. Faster, faster, faster!
Wait a minute, Mr. Bobbin. How fast do you want it?
Well, about a thousandth of a second between the ping and the pong. A little too fast for you, I'm afraid. But the principle's the same as the man and the hill. We know how fast radio waves travel. By measuring the time distance between the outgoing ping and the incoming echo, we can work out the distance of the aircraft from the transmitter.
You must have a pretty good stopwatch.
Oh, we have. It's not an ordinary watch, though. It's a cathode ray tube, the tube used in television. Now, a cathode ray tube...
No, thanks. Not yet. That's enough science for beginners at present. Time this story began. In the first few days of 1935, the Air Ministry was very concerned about the air defense of Great Britain. So they set up a committee which called upon the superintendent of the radio department of the National Physical Laboratory and laid its worry before him.
Should Britain be forced to go to war again, there is the strong possibility that we will be attacked by fleets of aircraft. We can't stop them, we will very soon be beaten. There is, of course, one obvious solution. Maintain standing patrols of aircraft. But that would mean that our supply of petrol, aircraft, and pilots would soon be exhausted. However, we would have a chance of stopping them if only we could get sufficient warning of their approach.
How much warning?
Well, the longer the better. The absolute minimum would be when the enemy were 35 miles from the coast.
I think we could promise you that. At least that.
A few weeks later, a handful of people gathered one morning in a laboratory near Daventry.
I don't think we'll keep you long, gentlemen. Remember, all we're attempting to do is to show you that we can detect an aircraft when it's out of sight and sound. We should also be able to make a rough guess as to how far it is away. Remember, too, the gear is very crude.
And this, Boffin, is where you give a quick description of a cathode ray tube.
Well, as I said, the cathode ray tube is our stopwatch for measuring the time interval between the sending out of the radio impulses and their return to us as echoes. Imagine a clock face. Wipe everything off it except the pointers. Put one pointer to 9 o'clock and the other at 3 o'clock, making a straight line across the center of the clock face. Now blacken the clock face and turn the pointers into a line of green light, a green, shimmering line of light. That line of light is our time base. When an echo returns from an aircraft, we make it strike the line of light, causing a blip of light to stick out from the line. The position of the blip on the line indicates how far away the aircraft is. That's putting it all ridiculously simple. Of course,
Good enough for us, Boffin. Come on, the experiment's about to start.
Well, this gentleman is the face of a cathode ray tube. Switch on. Recall that line of light across the tube, the trace. We've arranged for an aircraft to be flying some miles away. When it flies into the radio waves, we should get an echo back from it, and it should show on the trace as a slight distortion. Watch. Oh, that's it. An echo from the aircraft. You see it? The blip of light near the right-hand end of the trace?
Yes, I see it. A V-shaped bit. A bit of light sticking down.
Oh, all right. Gentlemen, you're watching an aircraft 8 miles away.
There's another blip.
Yes. On the trace, slightly nearer to the left-hand side of the cathode ray tube. Another blip of light. But this one's different, isn't it?
It is. It's deeper, much deeper. And it's got a steady beating motion.
Well, it's not one blip. It's three in one. Now, if you look closely, you can see the three separate parts. As that's not three aircraft flying in formation, I'll leave the aerial. You see the big blip, followed by the smaller one, moves slowly along the trace.
The big one split into two.
One of the three is broken formation. It's about 2 miles. The other two are following.
Are you sure?
If they keep flying on that course, you'll soon see, all right. They're flying straight. Come outside, will you? Yes, they're coming over. I can see what... and there are two behind them. And there's our target aircraft. We were right. Gentlemen, we can promise you a radio fence around Britain through which no enemy aircraft can break unperceived.
There were setbacks and worries, mistakes and disappointments. But good science learns from its errors. The work went on for 3 years. 1938, Chamberlain flies to Munich.
And five radio location stations watch him out from England.
Chamberlain flies back with a hope for peace.
But work continues on the remaining 15 stations.
September 1939, the 20 stations are equipped and manned. Scientists, controllers, observers, pilots, are you ready? Are you ready? War is here and manpower is short.
You young ladies were probably disappointed after joining the Women's Auxiliary Air Force to find that you'd been put down as clerk, special duty. I can relieve your minds now. You will not be clerks, though your duties will be very special. The name is meant to hide what you're really going to do. Now listen carefully to this. Everything you hear and learn and see in the course of your duties, you must keep completely secret. Your parents, your relatives, your friends, your boyfriends, they'll ask you what you're doing. Do not tell them. Smile. Say nothing. A word about your future job. It's probable that this country will be heavily attacked from the air. You all know what the Luftwaffe did to Poland. Your job will be to help to stop that happening to Britain. You've been picked for this job because you're intelligent and look confident and resolute. It's a big compliment. Live up to it. That's all.
Shall we be able to do it, sir?
Yes, you will do it brilliantly.
Where do we go from here, sir?
To a lonely CH station on the southeast coast of England.
It is called a CH station because it is part of a chain of home stations. Before your lorry reaches it, you will see the tall towers rising high above the trees. The sentries at the gates of the compound will examine your papers thoroughly, very thoroughly, for there is nothing in Britain guarded more carefully than your station. And in the corner of the compound, earthed over, sandbagged, blacked out, small and squat at the foot of the tall antenna towers, will be the hut. Even though you live in the compound, you will not be able to pass into the hut without the password for the day. A word, perhaps. Or perhaps the sentry will call out a number, and you will have to do a subtraction to give the correct answer.
Halt! Who goes there?
Friend.
Six.
Four.
Advance, friend.
Haven't seen you before. New?
Very. What's it like?
Gorgeous. Beer 5 miles away, pictures 12 miles. Mind you, you can always have a nice dip in the briny when the ice melts. All right, ladies, you can pass.
Good morning.
Good morning.
ACW Bright.
ACW Kane.
Right, I'll show you around. I'm the corporal in charge of this watch.
Oh, my word. What are all these...
Now, don't worry about all this gear. The wires and knobs and boxes and panels look terrifying, but it'll all sort itself out in time. Anyway, that corner's your main business, where the two air craftsmen are sitting side by side. Come over. The idea is for you to take their places soon.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Now, this man is the observer, and his job is to keep his eyes glued on the tube, watching the trace. The man sitting in front of the map is the converter. The converter's job is to plot the aircraft that the observer sees. The map is divided into lettered squares, and each square subdivided into numbers, see? That's so you can give a quick map reference. If he says, sugar 2345... he means an aircraft is in square S at that point there. Now, they both wear head and breast telephones connecting them to the filter room at Fighter Command Stanmore. At Stanmore, a plotter is listening to them the whole time. Nobody lets his attention wander at this job.
Hello, Stanmore.
Stanmore.
I've got a new response at 65 miles. One aircraft showing no IFF. Plot coming up.
Right.
That blip of light. That's an aircraft, 65 miles away. Now the observer swings the goniometer. That's for measuring the bearing.
Read. Sugar, 2565. Height coming up.
Now he turns the knob under his right hand. It shows the converter the altitude of the plane.
Read. Height, 20,000.
Make that hostile 6.
That's the Stanmore plotter. Any questions so far?
What did he mean by showing no IFF?
Well, it wouldn't be much good plotting aircraft if we couldn't tell if they were ours or Jerry's. You see, there's a gadget in our aircraft which slightly alters the echo, and it shows a difference on the blips. IFF means identification friend or foe. Just another little bit of radio location magic. Leave the girls to their bewilderment. Leave them to settle down to the quiet, lonely life, to the getting used to the blip leaping on the green, flickering trace, moving slowly to the left or to the right, until at last they can tell at times from which airdromes in France the aircraft have flown, and they can guess at times the direction of the wind blowing across that airdrome. Then one day there appears on the trace a bigger blip, deeper, wilder than the WAFs have seen before, beating in one place on the green line of light. Smaller blips move to meet it and become submerged in it and move away from it to the edge of the trace, then back again. And the tense WAFs are seeing not green light, but more than 200 Nazi aircraft hovering in the air. And the spot of light moving over the converter's map has come to rest at Dunkirk. Our turn next, says Britain.
Keep your eyes on the trace. It will come. It will come.
Hello, Stanmore. 6+ aircraft coming up at 60 miles. Plot coming up. Read.
Robot 9817.
Robot 9817. Make that hostile 7. Can we now have another plot soon, please?
Doesn't seem to be moving, but it's increasing in number, about 20 plus. We'll take a height. Read. Height 8,000.
Plot, please.
Still in the same area. Now 50 plus.
Here is the wonder of radiolocation. Out of sight, out of sound, across the channel, over France, German aircraft, bombers, and fighters are climbing from their airfields and orbiting around a rendezvous, circling as others climb up to join them. This is their moment, but they do not know they are being watched.
Hello, Stanmore. Hostile 7, still stooging about the same area. Now 150 planes plus.
Hilda, officer here. Give me a plot as soon as they begin to move.
Yes, sir.
For half an hour, the Nazi squadrons gather, unhurried, confident.
Hello, Stanmore. Hostile 7, now 250 plus. And they're coming in.
Plot, please.
Read. Robot 9433.
Robot 9433.
Hello, Stanmore. Range now 50 miles. Plot coming up. Read.
The Battle of Britain has started. The threat that was outlined 5 years ago has materialized. But the promise made in the field near Daventry to provide a warning of approaching aircraft is also a hard fact. The distance, the bearing, the height of the enemy plotted, the course marked on the control tables of fighter command, squadrons of Hurricanes and Spitfires are hurled into the path of the bandits.
Hello, Stanmore. Another response at 20 miles of 12 plus. It's behind and showing fighter IS.
They're ours. Make it fighter 6.
Hostile 7 now changing course. They seem to be heading for Dover. Range now 35.
12 Spitz just going over southwest. About 200.
Hello, Stanmore. Just got a visual on 12 Spitz going southwest at 200.
Hello, Stanmore. New response at 15 or 12 plus. Going out showing fighter IS. Read. Robot 4042.
Robot 4042.
Fighter 6 seems to have made contact with Hostile 7. They're beating at 15 miles.
15 miles out from the coast, the Hurricanes and Spitfires have dived out of the sun into the massed formations of Nazi aircraft. Surprised, startled, the bombers break formation and turn for safety.
Hello, Stanmore. 50 plus, breaking away from the mass and going out. Plot coming up. Read.
Robot 6534.
Hello, Stanmore. The whole of Hostile 7 sitting up and increasing range.
Hostile 7 breaking up and many of them turning for home. The first raid is nearly over.
Hostile 7, now range 40. Any gen, Stanmore?
Opsies 27 reported down so far. Only three of ours.
Hostile 7 faded altogether at 50, presumably landed.
The green trace is a thin line again. But day after day, the blips on the traces of the CH stations form and grow as the enemy squadrons gather over France. Day after day, the deep, wide, beating blips move to the left-hand side of the tube. But raid after raid is met and broken by the hurtling British fighters. Alarmed, worried, the enemy alters his tactics, changes his formation, tries feint attacks. But no matter what he does, he cannot find a stretch of the sky clear between him and his objective. His losses grow to frightening proportions. Desperate and guessing that the small buildings clustered at the foot of the tall aerials have a part in his discomfiture, he turns his attention to them.
Hello, Stanmore. Part of Hostile 86 is breaking away, about 20 plus at 15 miles.
Plotted separately.
Read. Robot 8017.
Call it Hostile 87. They're heading straight for you.
Hostile 87 coming in due north. Read.
Robot 5607.
Buried message read.
You're telling us.
Corporal, better warm the guns and bring up the standby diesel.
Right. Hello, guard room.
Aye.
Sound the camp siren.
Range 6 miles.
Hello, troop HQ.
HQ here.
Hostiles now at 6 miles. Can you see anything yet?
We can see 10, 12 or more. Look like JU-87s coming straight in. You under the table yet?
Get your tin hats, everybody.
Hello, Stanmore. They're overhead now.
Now the WAF operators show their mettle. Aircraft overhead, but they stick at their tubes, watching for other raids leaving France.
Another plot on hostile 96. Read. Robert 9648.
Sorry, can't hear you.
I'm not surprised. Robert 9648. Hello, Stanmore. Sorry, name's gone. We're off the air. We'll be back on standby diesel in a minute.
The tube is black. The green trace and the beating blitz have gone. But in a few moments, the standby generator is started, and the telephones are live again with fresh plots. Half of the roof of the CH's hut is gone. 30 bomb craters pit the compound. Day after day, the attacks on the CH stations continue. But not one station goes off the air except for a few hours. And the WAFs, already praised for their skill, are acclaimed for their courage, though the secrecy of their work forbids public recognition. By the end of September, it is obvious that the enemy has had enough. The traces in the CH stations become less distorted.
But the Battle of Britain is not over. The day battle is over. But the night battle is just starting. Jerry's changed his tactics, Boffin.
Yes, I know.
We can't catch him. We can't find him. During the day, it's good enough if you put a squadron within 2 or 3 miles of the enemy force. Then they can see them and do the rest themselves. At night, it's a question of one fighter against one bomber. And the fighter's got to be put within 200 or 300 yards of his target to see it.
But, Boffin, couldn't you have installed a small radio location set in each plane so that the pilot could find the enemy by himself?
Yes, that's exactly what we did. It took us over a year to develop sets small enough, but we managed it. AI, we call it. Aircraft interception. But for technical reasons, these aircraft radio location sets had a range of less than a mile. And to send a pilot in the air to find a bomber somewhere in 700 cubic miles of blackness, well, that's expecting the impossible.
Well, what did you do?
We had to devise a ground system which could watch the bomber as well as the night fighter. And by giving the directions, put him close enough to the enemy so that the fighter's own AI could pick up the target. That system we called GCI, Ground Controlled Interception. It meant we had to develop a new tube, which when used with a revolving antenna, produced a map on its face instead of the green line of light. Any aircraft in the air showed us a spot of light on the map, and its location could thus be determined.
Well, how did that help the night fighter in finding the enemy?
The ground controller could see both the enemy bomber and the night fighter. And by talking through radio to the pilot, he could give him directions to maneuver his plane close enough to the enemy so that his observer picked up the target on his own AI. Then the observer in the plane takes over and maneuvers his pilot into position for the kill. I well remember the first time we tried this system of ground-controlled interception.
Those aircraft sets ready yet, Boffin? We are screaming for them.
What date is it?
January the 6th, 1941.
Yes, blessed day they are ready.
Good show. Come on, get weaving.
In London, only a few hurrying footsteps break the silence of the street. Subway shelters are full. Firemen and wardens stir restlessly at their posts. The great city is waiting for the attack it knows will come.
Here they come, sir.
Good. Some customers soon. Yes, Sector?
Jerry's in your area on Zebra 6228. Have you got him?
Yes, we've got him. Now Zebra 6037.
That's him. He's now confirmed bandit. Take over Spider 13 and have a crack. He's a Zebra 8049. I'll hand him over.
The controller carefully lights a cigarette. If he does his work well in the next few minutes, lives and vital buildings will be saved, and another German bomber will not return to his base.
Hello, Spider 13. Are you receiving me? Over.
Hello, Badger. Loud and clear also. Over.
Hello, Spider 13. Have a customer for you. 15 miles west going north. Vector 310. Over.
310, right.
The chase is on. The bandit's echo is moving steadily across the face of the tube. The controller begins to maneuver the fighter so that the two echoes come together.
Target's course, 343.
Hello, Spider 13.
Go ahead.
Bandit now 8 miles west of you. Course, 343. Vector, 320.
The pilot moves the stick, and his bullfighter heels over. The controller has given him a cutting off vector, which should bring him just behind the enemy. The pilot pulls back the throttle, then turns the nose of his night fighter up, and his observer, sitting in the blackness halfway along the body of the bullfighter, stares at his AI indicator. He knows that any moment now, the responsibility for closing in on the target will be his.
Hello, Spider 13. Bandit dead ahead. Flash.
Right. I'm looking.
Flash. The observer knows now that at any moment he should see the enemy in his AI.
Hello, Badger. Contact. Out.
On the AI indicator in the bullfighter has appeared a blip of light. The enemy. The pilot stares at his instruments, ready to carry out immediately the orders from his observer, which will pour over the intercom.
Port gently. He's crossing to port. Range 3,000 feet. He's at 20 degrees up. 2,500 feet. Up a bit. Hard starboard! Harder!
The pilot's arm is aching as he jerks the bullfighter about the sky. Up. Down. Port. Starboard.
1,500 feet. Straight ahead. 20 degrees up. Nose up. Steady. 1,000 feet. 800 feet. Head ahead.
The pilot is now staring into the darkness. If his observer has done his work well, he should soon see the black shape ahead of him. Suddenly, he sees it.
Okay, I can see him. Yunker's 88.
He throttles back a little. He pulls back the stick. The nose goes up. The black shape fills his sight. Comes quickly. Before the Germans realize they are in danger, they are no longer men.
Hello, Badger. I got him. He's a flamer. Any more customers?
Yes, there are more customers, and week by week, the enemy losses go up.
May, 102 destroyed, 172 probable.
Finally, the enemy stopped coming over.
Good show, Bovin, and thanks a lot.
You have just heard How Radars Save Democracy, an excerpt from a British Broadcasting Corporation drama, originally written and produced in London for the BBC by Cecil McGivern. The music for the Columbia Workshop production was composed and conducted by Alexander Semler. Today's cast included Martin Wolfson as narrator and Horace Braham as Boffin. Others in the cast were Barry Kroger, Dick Nelson, Burford Hamden, Harold Young, Colin Keith Johnston, Alfred Shirley, Ile Benson, Hilda Palmer, Court Benson, and Alan Stevenson. How Radar Saved Democracy was directed for the workshop by John Veith. Next week, in anticipation of Independence Day, the Columbia Workshop will present This is Singing Country, which recalls the songs of American soldiers in the early years of the Republic. Written and arranged by Alan Lomax, This is Singing Country will be directed for the workshop by Howard G. Barnes. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.